Well, this is the Real BS Show, coming at you again from sunny Union City.
Yes. Beautiful downtown Union City.
Hey, I got a wood call from Titusville, and the guy was having a picnic or party or something, and he was kind of in a rush.
Uh-huh.
And I said, oh, yeah, Titusville, that's where I deliver there. And he said, well, it's... I'm right behind the Home Depot, and there's a plaza there with Walmart and Home Depot. And oh, I said, yeah, I know that. And then I thought about it. I said, well, wait a minute, that's south of Oil City, not Titusville. He said, oh, no, it's right south of Titusville. I said, no, you're all screwed up here. And the more we talked about it, I said, what state are you from? And he said, Florida, Titusville, Florida. I said, I could deliver. I said, but it's going to cost you a fortune. And here he was talking, he must have found my website. And
right.
Titusville, he just didn't put in pencil or Florida, you know, and so it popped up there.
That's funny.
He apologized. And all. I said, no, that's okay. That's, you know, it's kind of funny. But I mean, they had all the same stuff that what's up here, you know,
right.
Same kind of plaza and malls and whatever, all the same stores, same
right.
thing.
That's kind of hilarious. You know, I actually think what the problem is you know, I put on your site, I helped you with your website, and that's search engine optimization. I think your results are showing so high because you're getting hits from all these different places,
yeah,
you know,
a lot of,
and so he's getting your listing at top, and that's kind of hilarious, you know. It's only, but honestly, that's the funniest story you told me, because I was just down there at Cape Canaveral to watch a space launch, and it's one of those places I'd go again to.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really nice down there.
Yeah, I remember when I was down there for the video school, and I went out to Cape Kennedy and took the tour and everything, and it was pretty neat to see that stuff, and the way you go out that long road to go
right.
out there. To,
right.
I remember seeing alligators along the sides.
Yeah.
But it was quite an adventure, and quite something to see, really.
Right. Yeah. When we watched it, like I think you said it was like 9 seconds or 6 seconds for the sound to hit. That's exactly what happened.
Yeah, from the Cape Canaveral
right.
to the land there. It took a while, but boy, when it hit.
It rumbled. The other thing, too, was the light. It was at night launch, so the whole night, the whole sky just lit up.
Yeah.
And you could see the stage separation happen. And I think I couldn't contain my excitement because I kept on talking during the whole video that was recording. And I was like, I regret that now. I'm like, shoot, Seth, why'd you keep on talking?
Yeah.
You know? It's something special to witness and to realize that we were sending our own rockets again.
Well,
from the United
I went
States.
For a tour out there
right.
and they just moved the, it was the, not the new stuff, but it was the old stuff.
Right.
I forget what you call them. But it was all set up, and they were fueling it up out on the launch pad.
Right.
So we couldn't go right up to the launch pad. We
right.
got pretty close, but we couldn't get too close. But I saw the machine that took it out there, you know. It's got all these, caterpillar.
Right.
Tracks.
Huge machine, yeah.
Yeah, but there was, like, at each corner, and the thing went like 5 miles an hour
right.
or slower.
You're talking like the shuttle, right?
Yeah.
The shuttle launches. Yeah,
yeah,
those are huge.
But we went to that garage there where they said at that time it was the largest garage door in the world.
Right.
You know, that had to go up so they could take this thing out, you know, because
right.
it was pointed up in the air.
And right.
real slow. But the cement highway, the cement tracks that they went on, they said there was cement 11 feet deep.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I guess the sand didn't support
that. And they did that all on an island that's marshy and swampy.
Yeah.
You know, really, it's kind of like the peninsula in Erie, but it's...
Yeah, yeah, a lot like that.
But at the same time, this is like a marsh. It looks like a swamp, and they picked that location because they could launch the rockets to the east and make it the safest way to launch out into the ocean if something happened. And To me, it's a beautiful sight, what they've done there. I also went to St. Augustine, which is a very beautiful city. I suggest everyone to visit that.
Yes, old time Florida.
Yeah. But going back to the Cape, I wish I could have went down there again. There was two launches while I was down there in Florida, and I got to see the one right after just getting off the plane. And rented a car, drove down there, and with my father and my sister and my son, and I wanted to go back that Sunday because there was going to be another one, but I just knew that everybody was not game for it, and I wanted to go do you go onto the Cape Canaveral and see the actual tour and everything. I'd spend the money. I'd want to do that because
see, it was free when I was down there.
Right. Yeah. Well, it was free. It's free for you to go in there, but. Now that I was going to pay for the tour, the paid tour, yeah. And that's what I wanted to do is the paid tour.
Well, we went right into the control rooms, right. And all kinds of saw the lunar landers,
right,
and
right.
All that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah, that's all free and everything. But the reason I wanted to do the paid one is because then you get a lunch out of it. They you get a very nice lunch, and then on top of it, later on you can get a ticket to come back through, and you can get closer. To the launch than where I was. Where I was at was a very nice spot. It was near where they do the Cape Canaveral ships. The cruise ships come in. So I was down there watching it. It was a very nice spot. If you ever need to see any launches down there, that's a very nice spot. You can back in off a highway and just park and watch the launches from there. But I wanted to go in further and see the launches again and spend a whole day down there, but that didn't happen this time. I'll go down again sometime. Yeah. But I thought the story, you had to tell that story about the guy from Titusville, Florida. Yeah. It'd be even more hilarious if we could interview this guy, because this is like one of those weird situations that we don't probably think about too often.
We were both serious.
Yeah, I mean, right.
We were both talking, and and the situations were the same.
Right. The same stores.
The same stores. Locations. I said, but the only one problem is that what I'm talking about is south of Oil City, not Titusville,
right,
which is
right.
South of Titusville, but
right.
A bit farther south.
And he was even giving you the directions, too. And
yeah, he was telling me how to get to his house.
And you were like, oh, yeah, I know where that is.
Yeah, right. It's right behind that whole plaza there. Yeah, there's right. A road. I know.
And he agreed with you, didn't he?
It was something. Yeah.
That's the funniest thing in the world.
And after a while, I knew something was not right here. I said, wait a minute. And then finally I asked him, I said, what state are you in? And he said, Florida. I said, well, there's the problem right there.
Right.
I said, I'm in Pennsylvania.
Right.
Oh.
That is so funny.
And he apologized. I said, no, that's
it. You should say, mistake. If you ever come to Pennsylvania, I'll deliver wood for you.
Yeah. I'll probably never hear from him again.
No.
Still, it was quite a shocker.
Yeah.
How close to the same things that were built down there as it is up here.
We need to set up a GoFundMe so people can donate gas money so you can deliver this wood to in Florida.
Yeah, I told him I'd deliver it, but I said you couldn't afford the cost of delivery.
That'd take you like, 8 hours, 12 hours? No, longer than that. Heck, yeah, 19 hours, I think.
Yeah, that's half. Well, if you're pulling a trailer load of wood, too.
Yeah, it's another thing, too, yeah. This dawned upon me, 8 hours is like to Harrisburg or something. I my brain just went fart. I've drove down to the south before, and that's a long drive.
Well, Florida all by itself, from the top to the bottom, is a long drive.
Yeah. I was in Jacksonville, and my son wanted to go to Miami, and I was like,
We went
to the Cape Canaveral, and that was 2.5 hours. We went to Orlando, that was 2 hours and 40 minutes. If we went to Miami, that's like a 5-6 hour drive, and then you add traffic in.
At least double, yeah.
You add traffic in, then you're like, you're pulling hair out, you know.
Try to go to the Keys, and that's even farther.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing the Keys. You know, it's a very beautiful place. I keep on saying this to everybody. You know, you and I, you've been around the world, right? You know,
well, quite a bit.
Yeah, I've been around the world, and it's like I came back to the United States, and it's like every single time I think, man, we are so blessed here. We have such a beautiful country. There's so many different climates.
Yeah, and you don't have to boil the water every time you take a drink.
No, we have deserts, we have jungles, we have rainforests, we have tropical, subtropical areas, we have. Temperate forests around here, we have so many dang trees, it's crazy.
Yeah.
And we don't realize that, until you leave, how nice we have it.
Well, you want to know how nice you have it, just drive out west and see what that's like.
Yeah. I mean, that's,
What a difference.
Heck, in Florida, the only hills I saw were overpasses for interstates. You know,
yeah, right,
I mean, up
right.
here, you see hills all the time. You're driving them, you know. So it seems like you're in Germany. If you've ever driven in Germany, they have a lot of hills there and curves. And it reminds me of Pennsylvania. Yeah. Whereas in Florida, it's like straight roads.
Yeah, you get better flat gas mileage down there. It's all flat and straight.
Right.
And the roads are all nice, too.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, yeah.
You go Louisiana or Alabama, and things get a little bumpy.
Right, right.
Illinois is probably one of the worst states for roads.
That's probably the freeze-thaw. Same here. Our roads get destroyed from the freeze-thaw.
But you go out to Montana, and it's beautiful. The roads are just perfect everywhere.
And they go fast out there, too, can't they?
Oh, yeah. They got signs up with a question mark for speed limit.
That's funny.
But Wyoming and Montana and out there, it's pretty neat. Pretty neat stuff.
Now we got some clips here, audio clips of different people. What's this one guy that you were suggesting? Oh,
I wanted to play this Greg Mannarino. He's a guy I watch quite a bit.
Right.
Not every day, but quite a bit. And he kind of hit the nail on the head. He's talking about the economy and the way things are going. And it's a nice, I guess it's a podcast. But he talks about all this stuff, and I think he's more right than wrong. I mean, everything just appears. Now, it's pretty shocking. It's pretty eye-opening to hear this. But I think it'd be neat for everybody to give this a listen, you know.
Yeah.
And 5 years from now, you'd look back and say, hey, that guy was spot on.
Right. Kind of like Peter Schiff, you know, if people listen to him back in 2008.
You know, there's a bunch of different guys. But this guy, this time, you know, he kind of hit it the nail on the head. He was just referring to this Janet Yellen. What a nut job. I mean, she's on there saying everything's perfect and we couldn't be doing any better and blah, blah. There's no signs of anything. So what? She's just a bold-faced liar or she's just got dementia like
delusional.
Joe, you know?
Yeah.
Something's wrong. I mean, really wrong. And she's in charge of the Treasury Department. Holy catfish.
Right.
So anyways, let's give Greg a listen and see what you think. I mean, he's pretty interesting. And he might be spot on.
Right.
Okay, here we go.
Okay, everybody, here we go. It is me, Gregory Mannarino, pre-market report on this Tuesday, September 19th, 2023. With that said, let's start off with something I want to read to you, and I want you to pay attention to this. This is from Mrs. Wire, and the title of this is I think very appropriate, and these words here are really on point. So stay with me for a moment. Okay, here's the title: The Coming Collapse of the Global Ponzi Scheme. Goes on to say this: It won't be long before governments around the world, including the one in Washington, self-destruct. Now, you know me. I like to ad lib to these. I would say it's self-destructing right now. And that is a big sign of clearly a sign that the empire is collapsing. All great empires, as in everything else in life, go through cycles, okay? And this particular one is in a downward spiral, and I believe sincerely it is in collapse. Anyway, this goes on to say, strong words, but anything less would be naive. As economist Herbert Stein once said, listen to this, if something cannot go on forever, and this is a Ponzi scheme that we're in, of truly beyond belief proportions, it has a tendency to stop. Absolutely. Herbert here is on point. You and I know this, okay? We've seen it before. What happened last time? The meltdown of 2008 wasn't about the economy cratering, wasn't about the stock market cratering. It was the system was locking up. It was stopping. The music was stopping. What did they do? They had to inject billions of dollars into the system to free up the credit markets. It was over. All right. And again, what did they do? Easy Money, to the point of beyond belief, was pumped into the system to free it up. Interinstitution lending started, and we picked this back up. Now, since that time, the Federal Reserve, none more so than the Federal Reserve, other central banks around the world, have inflated a debt market hyperbubble, which is the greatest threat to humankind, period, the end. An alternative reality has been created, and all of this is going to end. So anyway, as economist Herbert Stein once said, if something cannot go on forever, it has a tendency to stop. It's going to stop again. Case in point, fiat money, political regimes, interventionist economies of the West are in a fatal downward spiral. Yeah, I think that this short piece here, you can look this up for yourself here, nailed it to the wall. Nailed it to the freaking wall. That's exactly where we are at, people. The music is going to stop. They're trying to tell you right now how great everything is. Everything is functioning perfectly. We're firing on all cylinders. It's the same story that we've heard over and over again prior to every single meltdown going back as far as you want to go. Then they start floating out the creatures like Janet Yellen yesterday, who said specifically there is no sign. No sign. She doesn't see a sign, at least. You know, she has her blinders on, quite obviously. And maybe she's a little demented. I would think that's probably the case as well. And, of course, she's a liar of the highest possible order. And we know all about this as well. The fact that she says she does not see a sign here that the U.S. economy is not doing too well, according to her, we're doing fantastic. You know for a fact that the polar opposite is true. Again, we're going to end up in a credit freeze. I've been telling you this for 10 years, people. All the music is going to stop, and I mean it's going to stop. That was the issue last time in 2008. See, they won't tell you this. They won't tell you that the real problem wasn't the economy crashing, wasn't the market crashing, it was the fact that the credit markets were locking up. When credit markets lock up, everything stops. No transactions, debit cards don't work, credit cards don't work, nothing works. Well, one thing would work, and that would be cash, believe it or not, or bartering. You understand? That's why I explain to people, you need to have some cash on hand. Some, you have to. Okay, in the event of a credit freeze, and in my opinion, it's unstoppable. A credit lockup of the system is going to occur. You will not be able to get your cash out of these institutions. Like I said, credit cards, debit cards won't work. Nothing. It'll all just stop. All right, and then you can imagine pandemonium in the streets as people flock. It's a bad word here. A swarm to the stores here to raid them, to steal whatever they need to survive, food, water, obviously, and stuff. This is how it's going to go. You have to be ready for a worst case scenario, because in my view, a worst case scenario is going to occur, okay? And I've been telling you, people are going to eat each other in the streets. There's going to be, you got to be prepared for this, people. I'm telling you right now, and I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but that's where we're going. And not only that, we have this growing threat against the U.S. dollar dominance. Let's put this together. A lot of you think this is not going to happen. I sincerely believe in my heart of hearts. And it's not just, how do I say this right? I study this stuff around the clock. I think about it around the clock, except for when I'm working on my cars, obviously. But it seems very evident to me that the world is sick and tired of the U.S. dollar dominance. Again, think about what I'm about to say real quickly. We have a situation here where our so-called leaders are, which is obviously the Federal Reserve is the government, and central banks are the government around the world. What they're doing here, and especially with, and here's where the problem arises, being that the U.S. dollar is, as of now, the world reserve currency, okay? You have irresponsibility or something else going on by our political leaders, by the central banks here, debts and deficits hyper-ballooning here with easy money. still being poured in. How is easy money still being poured in here by artificially suppressed rates? Even like this, well, tomorrow we're going to hear from the Federal Reserve with regard to monetary policy. Again, the world is sitting back and listening to what they're going to do here. The Federal Reserve, central banks around the world, they run the economy. They run the financial markets. They run the entire financial system. They control the money. They control the world. The rest of it is a freak show. The blues, the reds, the uniparty, whatever it is. Okay, wherever you live in the world, okay, it doesn't matter. It's the central bank setting the stage. So anyway, today starts the meeting for the Federal Reserve. 2 days. Tomorrow we get their monetary policy announcement. I believe they're going to raise rates 25 basis points. That's my take on it. I know a lot of you think that's not going to happen. The most likely scenario is a rate hike, 25 basis points. I don't even believe a pause is in the cards here, especially being that last week we just found out that wholesale inflation came in more than twice than expected. Not for you and I. We understand where this is going. Debts, deficits, easy money is why the dollar is under a greater threat today than ever before. And this issue with the BRICS nation cannot be overlooked. They are looking to corner the energy market, people, okay, in case you don't know. That's exactly what they need, and they will. There's no doubt. Without, again, the Federal Reserve is not going to give up the petrodollar that easy. They're going to sacrifice millions of lives, as they always do, to establish, at least try to keep the dollar in the position it has today as the world reserve currency. They will kill millions of people to keep that going here. So just be ready for that as well. But the threat to the U.S. dollar is not just from the BRICS nations and their alliances that they're making now with the major energy-producing countries, OPEC nations here. It's from within. You understand? Again, ballooning debts, deficits, easy money. This is all playing right into the threat, which is, I think, clear to the U.S. dollar dominance. Now, what does this mean? Again, the U.S. dollar being the reserve currency has allowed people here in the United States to live an alternative lifestyle. We have been exporting inflation to the rest of the world via this mechanism, and the rest of the world is sick of it. We've lived a lifestyle for decades, many decades, that we shouldn't be living in. The privilege of having the world reserve currency has allowed us this. It's going to change, and I want you to be ready for that as well. Absolutely. So again, just going back, I want you to think about what I'm saying here. It's not just the threat of the BRICS nations cornering energy, looking to circumvent the dollar, other nations around the world as well. It's the threat is from within here, with debts and deficits ballooning, easy money. That is maybe even a greater danger. So just understand this: the U.S. dollar is not going to remain the world's reserve currency. I don't think for much longer, I'll be honest with you. The system is coming apart, and I think what you really need to be looking out for is this. Clearly, I mean, you know, look, I mean, this little thing here is we're in a fatal downward spiral. I know I'm preaching to the choir. I've been telling you this for a long time. It's over. But anyway, just be ready for this, people. Going back to the market real quick. Actually, I didn't cover it at all. You have stock futures, which are slightly higher today. Risk in this market, still in a very, very bad spot. I think the debt market is flashing red at this particular time without direct intervention, meaning, number one, a suppression of the 10-year yield, a weakening of the dollar, or the Fed gets in here and starts buying the market, which they do. They have a trading desk. They buy large cap stocks to prop up the market. It's just over. But the illusion of the market is more than likely going to be maintained no matter what happens until after the presidential selection cycle. This is a selection. You don't get to choose. Understand that. You think you do. That is an illusion. You have no say-so at all about how this is going to play out here. This is not the United States of America that you and I grew up with. Things have changed dramatically. And I think that's pretty obvious as well. Going back to the market again, cryptocurrencies catching a bid. Gold and silver catching a bid. U.S. dollar on a relative strength basis is lower this morning. Crude oil continues to march higher. It's a phenomenon that is quite unbelievable. We basically have gone straight up since $67 a barrel. We are now $93 a barrel. It's an amazing phenomenon to see. But Saudi Arabia says that they're not cutting oil production because they want to keep the price propped up. Oh, it's not that. this is obviously also part of a strategy to bring the United States to its knees. Saudi Arabia now joining the BRICS nations, here, they understand people here in the United States and in Europe as well, around the world, the general population is being destroyed, systematically erased, having to deal with inflationary pressures across the board, food inflation, energy inflation, and outpacing it all as you and I knew it would. Anyway, that's where we're going. So today is the Fed meeting, first day. Tomorrow is the announcement. You know where I stand on this.
There it is. It's a bit scary, but I don't know. I mean, it's very possible. I mean, credit cards don't work.
Right.
ATM cards, you know. He says it's best to have a little cash.
Right.
Stuffed away just in case. But who knows? Someday that won't work either.
Right. There's a certain balance of everything, you know. Being prepared is good. You know, what I always say is, you know, we're not trying to be scaremongers. We're just trying to say, be prepared for the worst possible situation. If it gets really bad, then, yeah, things are just not recoverable at a certain point. But I think what we're seeing is a gradual change in the whole world. It's not just the United States either. You know, you look at all these different countries, and you can see their currencies just inflating, and China's not doing well with their currency as well. They're globally, it's like you look at Europe and stuff, the EU, they have worse inflation in the EU than we do. Or Venezuela, you look at, they have 400% inflation in Venezuela. Argentina is 120%. You know, we have our problems, but...
it's the government. To me, it's the government.
Oh, yeah, all these governments,
They're spending money like it's water, and,
right.
and you're just printing it. Federal government's causing this.
Do you know what the, when you were, let's say, I was born in 1983, I'm about to give my age away, but I remember reading the inflation. What do you think was the inflation? It was like in millions? The debt, national debt was in the millions?
Back in the 70s?
80s, 83, yeah.
Probably roughly billions.
Billions, yeah.
800 billion, maybe.
Yeah. Well, not even that, I don't think.
Maybe not that high.
No, definitely, because the 800 billion was roughly about 2000. It was not even a trillion then at that point. The point is we've had trillions of dollars added. So it's crazy.
So fast,
It's so fast, and nobody's questioning it. This is just okay. It's like that one meme with a dog sitting there drinking tea, and the house is on fire, and the dog's saying, "This is fine." To me, it's like fine. Everything's fine. We're just we're all good. But I don't know. There's the next one that...
You have to talk about this one because I haven't heard it.
I don't want to give too much away to it, but a lot of people talk about the Great Reset, and... I think...
Well, most folks don't even know what that is.
Yeah, I think we should focus more on the Great Escape more than the Great Reset. So I think this next clip, audio clip, is pretty self-explanatory, and we'll just play it.
Okay. It's all on you because I've never heard this, so I don't know what's coming.
All right, the Great Escape.
The coronavirus pandemic has no parallel in modern history. It is our defining moment.
Those are the words of Klaus Schwab, head of the World Economic Forum, in COVID-19, the Great Reset.
People assume we are just going back to the good old world, which we had, and everything will be normal again in how we are used to normal, in the old fashion. This is, let's say, fiction. It will not happen.
At the latest World Economic Forum meeting in Davos, Schwab set the tone for the conference with his glowing introduction of the opening speaker.
We now welcome His Excellency Xi Jinping, President of the People's Republic of China.
Xi laid out his vision of a coordinated global economy.
Major economies should see the world as one community and coordinate the objectives, intensity, and pace of fiscal and monetary policies.
This ideal of a united globe with a coordinated economy managed by experts captures Schwab's vision of the post-COVID world.
We have to redefine our social contract.
These grand proclamations, the ominous book title, and Schwab's odd personal style have led many people to speculate that the Great Reset is part of a conspiracy of global financial elites and politicians to depopulate the planet so they can more easily institute one world government, or even that COVID was engineered to that end.
Remember the stated goal by these people.
Billionaire transhumanist elites, the globalists that all get together every year.
Is depopulation of the planet.
A transhumanist revolution.
To make people chronically sick.
That results in the death of the vast majority of the world population. And out of that cataclysm, a new super race.
I don't buy it. Imagine the amount of coordination and airtight secrecy needed for these kinds of far-reaching conspiracies of global domination to succeed. They'd be exposed and fall apart, especially in the age of the internet. Instead of spinning our wheels searching for a secret agenda, let's just look at the one that's right out in the open.
I think we are moving from short-term to long-term, from shareholder capitalism to stakeholder capitalism.
What China, the World Economic Forum, and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren have in common is that they favor so-called stakeholder capitalism, which is a euphemism for making companies answer first to special interests. They want to reorganize corporate boards to include representatives from labor, environmental, and social justice groups. Warren proposed a bill to require 40% of large corporate board seats be elected by workers. In China, the state simply owns or controls a majority stake in most of the country's largest firms. The World Economic Forum and many state leaders believe global coordination and global governance is essential to manage global problems, climate change, international financial instability, and future pandemics. A crucial flaw in Schwab's Great Reset is that it puts too much faith in the ability of governments to re-engineer society in a way that better serves the needs and desires of all citizens. He wants a rethinking of capitalism that escapes the tyranny of GDP growth, so that companies create goods and services for the common good instead of maximizing profits. The phrase common good points to his fundamental misunderstanding of capitalism, which is nothing new. Central planners were using this idea to maximize their own power at the expense of individual freedom back in the 1940s when Nobel Prize-winning economist F.A. Hayek wrote The Road to Serfdom, which would go on to sell over 2 million copies. The welfare and happiness of millions cannot be measured on a single scale of less and more, Hayek writes, and depends on a great many things that can be provided in an infinite variety of combinations. Every single one of the billions of people who populate this planet have unique goals and desires that are impossible to reduce to a unified whole, whether that's GDP or whatever supposedly holistic metric the WEF wants to replace it with. Profits are a signal to entrepreneurs that they are satisfying the disparate needs of their customers.
One of the great lessons of the past 5 centuries in Europe and America is this. Acute crises contribute to boosting the power of the state. It's always been the case, and there is no reason why it should be different with the COVID-19 pandemic.
Schwab is right that the war is the health of the state, as the writer Randolph Bourne once put it. And the government's response to COVID has been similar to military conflict in terms of the cost and the chaos it's engendered. World Wars I and II and the Great Depression ushered in a powerful modern welfare and warfare state that irreversibly altered America and the world. But I'm more optimistic this time, thanks in large part to the power of technology to provide everyday citizens with an exit. Instead of the Great Reset, in which sclerotic 20th century institutions accumulate even more power, I think we're entering the Great Escape. This is possible because technological progress is outpacing the ability of the state to control and regulate it. Governments will have no choice but to abandon their efforts to construct physical and metaphorical walls. Technology can be designed to facilitate decentralization, in which the flow of money and information can't be controlled. Ideas emerge from the bottom up, expecting governments and international bodies to orient every large company towards some widely agreed upon common good. Assumes that many of the very institutions that bungled the COVID-19 response can competently handle the planet's most intractable problems. My hope is that after witnessing the colossal failure of governments in the face of a global crisis, many more people will be looking for a different approach. There's evidence everywhere of the Great Escape. The U.S. population shift away from expensive, restrictive, and poorly governed states and cities, spurred on by the rise of remote work. The exodus from government-run schools. The growing use of cryptocurrency. The popularity of encrypted private communication platforms. And the expanding reach of independent voices in our increasingly decentralized media. Hayek called central planning the fatal conceit, writing that the curious task of economics is to demonstrate to men how little they really know about what they imagine they can design. And Schwab even touches on this idea, writing that complexity creates limits to our knowledge and understanding of things. It might thus be that today's increasing complexity literally overwhelms the capabilities of politicians in particular and decision makers in general to make well-informed decisions. He dubs this quantum politics, but never quite explains how policymakers will realistically overcome this dilemma. Maybe there's record low trust in our institutions because the people running them are attempting the impossible, planning the future for billions of people. Humiliating to pride as it may be, Hayek wrote in The Constitution of Liberty, advancements of civilization are often happy accidents, and policymakers could and should be more focused on securing the freedom that allows such decentralized experimentation and accidental progress to occur. The fear of a great escape, of losing control, is understandable because there are systemic risks that could destroy human civilization, including future natural or man-made pandemics, runaway inflation, and ecological disaster.
Small boats may not survive a storm, but a giant ship is strong enough to brave a storm.
But if we're all stuck in the same large ship, in the same storm, we're all going down with it when the winds finally get bad enough. Concentrated power itself presents an existential risk. A bad intervention applied to economies of the entire world at once can bring down the entire system. But the distributed power and humble trial and error of markets and decentralized governance brings progress in fits and starts with less risk of total ruin. What Schwab, Xi, and central planners around the world miss is that when securing the rights of the individual comes first, the rest tends to follow. The great escape from the 20th century is underway, and there might be nothing they can do to stop it. The question is, do they make getting there easy, or does it happen the hard way?
This is the Real BS Show, and, you know, I think that was a good segment there. It's something, you know, you may not agree with everything that we put on here, but you can at least maybe just learn a little something, maybe hear from something
we'll
from the other
agree
side.
Agree to disagree.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you had an interesting situation. It's kind of like, you know, an odd thing, I thought. You had a battle with a cardinal.
Oh. My car.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you Googled it, and sure enough, there it is.
Yeah. There's tons of people having the same problem as you. That's the weird part.
Yeah. Well, it never happened to me before, but now, holy smokes.
So to clarify the Google thing, I was searching. I put in how to stop cardinal, and then I stopped there typing in the autocomplete for Google for, like, many searches, like what many people type, showed up. Stop attacking my car windows, mirrors, my car mirrors.
Yeah.
And I that's what, okay, go ahead with your story.
Exactly what, you know, this cardinal was just going nutty over there, and he was on the far side of the car, so it was, you know, but he's looking at himself in the rearview mirror, you know, the side mirror, and attacking himself, you know, just going crazy over there. But in the meantime, he's pooping all over the side of my car. I mean,
right,
just
right.
A big, giant mess.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, what the heck? So I put a plastic bag over it, and that worked for a while. But then he figured out how to pull it off.
So it was like almost like a game where he's like, oh, I can continue this game almost. Not really,
boy,
probably
just,
a game.
Just incessant attacking but, himself
right.
in the mirror.
But he figured out how to pull the bag off. That's hilarious. That's the part that got me. That's when you said that, I just started busting up laughing.
What that one thing said, get a Protestant car?
Get a Protestant car, yes.
So anyway.
Get a guard cat. That's another one side.
I never knew that. I never experienced that before. But this, I mean, just the car. No other birds, just that cardinal, and he's still there. But I mean, Unreal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Get a Protestant car or get a guard cat.
I tried
cat.
Taking the food away. I said, oh, I'll quit putting food in the bird feeder. That didn't help anything.
Right, right.
You know, he just had to be there.
I guess the scientific answer is that cardinals are territorial. The males are. So they see the reflection and they get like crazy where their nest is. So they'll start attacking. And they're not the brightest animals. I mean, crows are very intelligent. But cardinals, maybe on the lower end there of the IQ level.
I don't know, but he's amazing. Just amazing the way he is incessant.
I just think that it was a good story that we had to include on that. And talking about mentally challenged animals, we have a segment about Harrisburg. It's our state capital of Pennsylvania. We got a lot of problems around the country in different places, and you know, a lot of cities that are near bankruptcy that are requiring other parts of the states of those states to fund those cities. And some people are going to be rolling their eyes at me saying this, but you know, we look at the turnpike. It's like I think $118 to go from one end to the other, and that money's
in a car.
In a car, yeah. And
if that's, you're in a truck, look out.
That's funding Philadelphia basically with their transit system. But in this segment here, we're talking about Harrisburg, and some of the choices that they made in that city are reaching out to the state level. And there's many people talking about Detroit or Chicago or Philadelphia or New York City or L.A. about their problems. That's all fine and dandy. But I think in many ways what's happening in Harrisburg is bound to happen to more cities because of the way they're running things.
Well, when I was the mayor of Union City, I had a sit-down with Governor Corbett. I forget his name. Governor Corbett.
Yeah, Governor Corbett, yeah.
I just called him. He was... We call him General Corbett because he was the attorney general before he became the governor.
Right.
But he flat out said that Philadelphia is going to go bankrupt and they're going to require the rest of the state to bail them out. And he might have been a little ahead. This was like 2007, I think, someplace right in there. He's a little ahead of schedule, but I think that's coming around right now. Well, Harrisburg's a good example because they did go bankrupt.
Yeah.
And I guess you got a story there about it.
Yeah.
I haven't heard this one either yet.
Erie's facing the same problems. There's a lot of businesses leaving the area. That area. There's,
I refuse to go to Erie anymore. I just will not go down there. I don't want no part of Erie.
It's crazy seeing the sprawl happen. Even to this day, you know, they used to say that, you know, when I was a kid growing up, they used to say, oh, Erie's going to connect all the way to Union City at some point. It'll be an urban sprawl. And it ended up kind of stopping in Summit. It never kind of expanded faster than that. But now it's starting to pick up a little bit. People are leaving Erie. I lived in Erie for a short bit. And, you know, there's a lot of nice people in Erie. I'm not going to dog Erie completely, but they have a lot of problems. Their school systems is, you know, they keep on saying it's underfunded. Well, you keep on throwing money at the problem. It's obviously not fixing it. That's a whole segment. We could do a whole show on how funding's given.
Well, I was talking to people when I was the mayor. I was talking to people in Waterford, you know, because they don't even have a police force in Waterford, and they were telling me about the welfare recipients leaving Erie.
Yep.
And I said, well, where do they end up in Waterford? He said, they don't. He said, they skip right over Waterford and go right to Union City.
Yeah, yeah. That's because what's happening in Erie is with the housing, the HUD program there, there's a long wait list in Erie. So what happens is a lot of people are wising up and realizing the county HUD does not have as long of a wait list. So you can get into housing much more quicker if you go through the county housing authority. And so that's what's happening. Union City, Corey, Albion, and I'm trying to think of the other one. I think Girard maybe are hot spots for housing. And many people are moving to those areas. Whereas Waterford, there's not too many people taking Section 8 there. That's a big part of it.
Well, it's growing. I mean, they're starting to get more of that. But I mean, for a while there, the early 2000s, it was just a mass exodus.
Oh, sure. You can see it too. Like, you know, I'm not some of the xenophobic at all. I like people. I don't mind people being my neighbor. Let's just say that I'm pretty, as long as they don't harm anybody. But I can tell when somebody's not from this area, and So it's interesting seeing this happen over the last 20 years, the increase of people moving out here. And, you know, a lot of them actually get off that program. So I see hope in people getting away from it because it is a trap in my eyes. They're getting stuck into a vicious poverty cycle. But if they escape it, good for them, because it's never fun being in a cycle that you can never get out. It's like the crab barrel, where the crabs are trying to get out and they're getting sucked in. But Harrisburg,
this would be interesting to hear. I didn't know it was that bad.
We saved this one for the end for a reason. I think it's one that kind of encapsulates many problems that are coming to the rest of American cities. And again, it's not a dog on cities at all. It's just a reality check.
Well, it's not that it's coming to American cities. It's already here. Yeah. I mean, if you drive through Baltimore, you go through Indianapolis, Indiana, you go to Chicago.
New Orleans, you go to Houston.
These cities are just unbelievable. Yeah. How would anybody want to live there?
How many people are leaving? Like in this story, they talk about how many people are leaving Harrisburg and everything, but the same thing is happening in LA right now. There's a mass exodus away from LA.
You can't afford the taxes out there in California. Yeah. It's just unbelievable. Yeah.
There's a saying, don't California my Texas. And it's interesting to see that there's a lot of people in Idaho getting upset about Californians or people from Oregon.
Yeah, they got signs out there that says, Californians, turn around and go back home. Yeah. We don't want you here.
Yeah.
In Montana, Idaho, Utah, I mean, those surrounding states, they don't want all this California refugees.
You know, it's kind of shocking seeing people move to the South, and I understand why. They're looking for jobs and better weather, quote-unquote better weather. But the reality is this up north, there's a reason why many people were up here originally. Is because, we have the four seasons, and jobs are kind of stagnant in the area or decreasing. But really, it's not a bad area. It's very nice nature. There's a lot, you know. I actually hope more people move away so that it's like, you know, more nature, more spaces for nature and cheaper properties. And, you know,
Pennsylvania is a beautiful state. There's no doubt about it.
So many trees. I almost say too many trees, but it's true.
My daughter just came back for, I don't know, a week or so to visit from Colorado, from Denver.
Right.
And the first thing she did was get a haircut. She said it's $200 to get a haircut out.
Wow.
And then you got to wait 2 weeks to get an appointment.
Right.
So she come back here and got one for $30.
$30. That's still expensive to me. I cut my own hair, so. You
know. Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. Everybody's different, but. And
$200, though.
Couldn't get over all the green. Everything's green back here.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, out west, everything's brown.
Yeah.
Big time.
They're going through a massive drought. We had a small drought here, but green here.
Well, it's been that way for a long time out west. I mean, it's just, you know, the only green you see is along rivers and stuff. But it's a big, big difference. But now all this craziness in California is coming to everybody. Well, Harrisburg's a good example. You just never believe it. They're bankrupt. They've been bankrupt for I don't know how many years now. And it's not getting any better.
And who's going to pay for that?
Yeah, well, all the farmers and all the, you know, rural areas, those people, the taxes.
The people that I call that are productive. We have to separate. You know, there's some people that want to sit there and separate people into upper, middle, and lower class. How about we start actually split it out into productive versus non-productive?
Yeah.
And that means including people that are rich. There's rich people that are not productive. And I'm not centered to say we need to be 100% efficiency, 100% always working, 100%, you know, never taking a break. I'm not that. We don't want to be like Japan where or South Korea and overworking yourself, working, you know, 17-hour days. That's not healthy. But I think there's a difference between those who produce and those who don't. And I think it's a merit-based. You know, if you produce, you should be rewarded for it. If you don't produce, then what are you adding to society? What are you adding to the whole, your community? Are you just sucking away from your local community, then that's not good. It's not good. You should be pulling weight for your own community. And I'm not even talking about state. People say, oh, state rights and everything. I'm saying local rights. You know, get down to your local level and see what's needed in your community to help and help raise your community up. And there's a lot of people in Union City doing that. You know, there's some people that, you know, that are really out there helping. They're, you know, volunteering. Their names are never even in the public what they're doing. and they're volunteering behind the scenes. We need more of that. Not boastful people just going out, you know, but people generally out there, there's ones that their names are never mentioned. And you see this in other cities. Well, you know, going to Harrisburg, there's people struggling there and they're still helping, but they're dealing with a system that keeps on bringing them back down to the bottom of the barrel. And that's not, it's, there's, that's where that corruption needs to be wiped clean and allow people to be free to help each other.
I don't know. It's just, wherever there's a problem, it's probably government's fault.
That's right.
You know, it's just trying to do too much with, I don't know, other people's money, I guess.
Right. Well, it's also, you know, you think about humans are corrupt, right? You know, we recognize that when someone says, oh, I don't lie, that's they're lying to you. So every human lies. Every human's corrupt. Everyone has a sense of pride that's too boastful at times. And there's some people that have less of that than others. But the reality is, why would you take a bunch of humans, which are corrupted, and say that magically, now that they're elected, they are going to be noble in their job? No, we shouldn't trust them. There's a saying, Sword of Dionysus. I think that's what it is. I'm going to have to look that up here. And what the concept is the sword should be above their head, knowing that it's being hung by a horsehair, that if they are corrupt, then that sword will come down on them because they're being unjust. Damocles. Sword of Damocles. And that concept should be for every government position, especially like police, you know, military. They should know that they're not invincible, and our government is not invincible, that they're being held to a standard of a higher standard than what is... They're not above a citizen, for instance. So, for instance, police are just citizens. They're not military. Military is not above citizens. They're actually protecting the civilians. So they shouldn't be held above civilians. They should actually be realizing that they're doing a job that's hard to do, but respectful of the community. And having that sword above them, that sword of Damocles above them, is an example. If you can Google that one, that's one that's a good one to read there. So...
It's a matter of who's footing the bill, and it's not the police, it's not the military, it's the public.
That's Cicero there. We know we did the Stoic episode last time, but Cicero is a good guy, another good read. He's a philosopher, a Roman philosopher that was a Stoic in some ways. But I think that's one right there. If we have that sword above us, whenever you do something, then it'll keep you in check. It keeps you in a boundary that you don't get corrupt. And it's having a moral standard, I guess. I guess that's a wrong thing to say these days. But, yeah, we'll play this segment here about Harrisburg.
Yeah, this is an eye-opener, so we'll stay tuned.
Harrisburg is the capital of Pennsylvania, and it's one of the brokest cities in America. The municipal government has so much debt, last year it attempted to file for bankruptcy. There isn't much of a 1% to help Harrisburg pay its debt. A third of its residents live below the poverty line, and its population has been gradually shrinking. Harrisburg's decline presents an extreme case of what's happened in municipalities across the country. It's a cautionary tale of how the ambitions of a charismatic mayor can destroy a city. American cities are drowning in debt. Thanks to a spending binge that took off in the mid-90s, local governments owe more than $2.8 trillion, and many lack the means to make good on those obligations. Harrisburg is one of a handful of cities that have effectively gone bankrupt, and many more are expected to follow suit. Reckless spending did more than ruin Harrisburg's balance sheet. It undermined the city's economy and purpose. Stephen Russell Reed, who declined to be interviewed for this story, was mayor of the city for 28 years, and he bears most of the responsibility for Harrisburg's nightmare.
If what happened in Harrisburg happened to our country, we would clearly call it a dictatorship.
Jason Smith is a designer and small business owner who ran for mayor against Reed in 2005.
You can't have an authentic public process when money is moving around without oversight and being spent on things that no one wants.
I don't see anything wrong with government being entrepreneurial.
Randy King was Mayor Reed's communications director for 18 years.
You have to understand the circumstance. In the early 1980s, Harrisburg was dead. There was no businesses downtown. Its population had declined by more than half in the past 20 years. He believed differently about Harrisburg and about cities in general. He believed it's a responsibility of the leadership of the community to step in and do things occasionally when there's a need that private sector isn't addressing.
Many cities spend taxpayer money subsidizing sports arenas. Harrisburg outright built a baseball stadium, and then it also bought the team that plays there to prevent it from moving to Springfield, Massachusetts. Many cities subsidize hotels and convention centers. Harrisburg outright bought a hotel to keep it from shutting down. Many cities subsidize museums and cultural institutions. Mayor Reed wanted to build his own museums, which he believed would transform Harrisburg into a tourist mecca.
Much as Washington, D.C. and its many museums draws millions of people to the city each year, or New York City, that's what Steve Reed's vision for Harrisburg was.
Reed conceived of a museum all about life on the frontier, so he headed west to start buying artifacts.
He bought a stagecoach, a Gatling gun, canned goods, badges, boots.
You have all that together in one town. Wow. You are a nationally scaled, national class tourism attraction.
He bought a warship from the War of 1812. It was burned and sunk, but he got the embers anyway. We always used to joke, you know, sell Annie Oakley's underpants.
The museum plan was ultimately shot down. Today, most of Reed's collection is sitting in a warehouse.
It would have been a big hit. I'm really sorry that that never manifested.
The mayor's dream of a National Civil War Museum did become a reality, but in a way that would have disappointed Honest Abe. Reed spent more than $16 million in city money acquiring the collection. When that wasn't enough, he took money from the Harrisburg Authority, a branch of local government that's responsible for maintaining the city's waste and water systems.
I think he learned early on that it's possible to borrow money for one thing and move the money into funds no one's heard of to get blank checks to buy whatever you want.
The mayor often lacked scruples when spending those blank checks. Harrisburg borrowed $3.7 million to help build this office complex for a printing company. The project went awry when the developer was indicted for embezzlement. Harrisburg's incinerator debacle was its best known and costliest venture. The incinerator, which was built in the early 70s, was a lemon from the very beginning. Reed hired an incompetent contractor to renovate the plant and then neglected to get insurance on the job. Today, the city owes $310 million on the incinerator. That's a little more than half Harrisburg's total liabilities, which add up to $610 million, according to the city controller, although nobody knows the exact figure, since Harrisburg is 4 years behind in completing its financial statements. Harrisburg, like many American cities, was so preoccupied with building white elephants that it neglected core functions like education and public safety.
Harrisburg, on a per capita basis, is one of the most violent cities in Pennsylvania.
Matt Bruett is the president of the Commonwealth Foundation, a libertarian think tank in Harrisburg.
Those who can live outside of the city are certainly choosing to do so, and we've seen that with the population shifts. This is not a place to raise a family.
About 60% of Harrisburg students are failing, according to Pennsylvania's statewide achievement tests. Mayor Reed addressed this problem by pouring money into school construction. The Harrisburg School District has racked up $270 million in debt, which is about 2.5 times Pennsylvania's average school debt per capita.
Everyone agrees the schools look great. They may not have books, the weightlifting room may not have weights, and the students might be the worst performing in the state, if not the nation, but the buildings are beautiful.
Failing schools were a major factor in driving Harrisburg's middle class to the suburbs.
My family left Harrisburg 2 years ago. We decided we could go somewhere where there's a good school district and property taxes will be lower. I have a number of friends who are now trapped in the city. They can't sell their houses and they simply can't leave.
The revitalization of the city isn't going to be done, at least in a sustainable manner, through political force. It's going to have to be a change that comes because you've created a climate that is of welcoming families, welcoming businesses, and until you have a mayor and a city council that recognizes their job isn't job creation, their job is getting better schools, better crime, all those things will contribute to the quality of life.
Harrisburg's tax base is so depleted, there's no way it can make good on its debt. Ultimately, state and county taxpayers will bear the burden of Harrisburg's recklessness.
The economic mess is coming to an ugly end, and that is a wonderful step forward for Harrisburg. I know that sounds terrible, but we can't live in delusion forever. And at some point, you got to say, what is the reality? People are going to be re-empowered to say, okay, well, it's not as rosy as we thought it was, but here's what it is. What are we going to do with it?